From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The eccentric chess genius Bobby Fischer died in 2008 with a tarnished reputation. When he defeated the Soviet Boris Spassky at the height of the Cold War, Fischer was one of the world's most famous people and a national hero, really. He was the undisputed world champion, and yet he practically disappeared at the time. Resisted the attention and the accolades, aimlessly wandered the world, displayed erratic, disturbing behavior, rabid anti-Semitism. In a new biography of Fischer's life, Frank Brady says it's easy to despise Bobby Fischer and to admire him at the same time. Today in the program, Brady will join us to talk about a deeply troubled soul who was also a serious and great artist with a deep passion to know. The book is called Endgame. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1972, Bobby Fischer was on top of the world. He had defeated the Soviet chess champion Boris Spassky. At the height of the Cold War, he took the world chess title back from the Russians, who had held it for more than three decades. Back in the United States, Fischer had become a national hero. The game of chess had become a phenomenon. He was on the cover of magazines, hounded by the press, a favorite on television programs. And Fischer gave in to the attention for a time. But it wasn't long before he would disconnect himself from all of that. In some ways, he practically disappeared. He became a mysterious figure, aimlessly wandering the world, displaying erratic, disturbing behavior, rabid anti-Semitism. In a new biography of Fischer's life, Frank Brady says, it's easy to despise Bobby Fischer and to admire him at the same time. Today in the program, Brady is joining us to talk about his book. It's called Endgame. Frank Brady is a biographer who has written books about Orson Welles and Barbara Streisand, among others. He's also the founding editor of Chess Life and a professor of communications at St. John's University in New York. Endgame is Brady's latest book, and it's also his second, we should say, on Bobby Fischer. His first was called Profile of a Prodigy, published in 1965. Frank Brady joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. Frank Brady, welcome. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
I wanted to begin with an essential question that you write about. I guess in some ways it's at the heart of the book. You yourself, of course, knew Bobby Fischer quite well. And I guess the question came to you a lot, and it's a question that you get at in the book. What was Bobby Fischer really like? Talk about that question, if you would, because it serves as an important part of the book.
Well, there seems to be many Bobby Fischers, and I think Virginia Woolf said if you're writing a biography of someone, you have to write about all of their selves, and it's impossible to write about all of their selves because we are many different people. We have different personalities. Bobby, as a young boy, seemed quite pleasant. He didn't get a feeling he was a kid from Brooklyn. Somehow he was... seemed like he was a kid from Kansas. You know, he was very pleasant, the way he dressed and the way he looked, and he smiled a lot, and he wanted to be engaging. He wanted to be liked. He was very, very, very bright. And then as he grew older, he became more curmudgeonly and more antagonistic to various people. He wanted things the way he wanted them.
Yeah.
And when he wanted them, and there was no argument. He always felt he was right. And so it was difficult being with him later on in life. And I'm talking about even late teens, early 20s,
yeah.
And then straight up until the time he was 29 when he played Spassky in Iceland for the World Championship.
I wonder how your personal relationship with Fischer influenced the way you told the story. It's hard, I imagine, to be dispassionate about Fischer, but you point out, we should explain, this is not a memoir.
Not at all. And I tried to remain as invisible as possible in the book because I wanted to tell his story, not my story, as seen through my eyes. There were many things I left out, actually, that were very personal to me, and I experienced them, but it would have had to be told through my eyes and through my memory. So I had a sort of love-hate relationship with Bobby. I considered him to be, and still consider him to be, the greatest chess player who ever lived. And being a chess player myself, I'm the president of the largest chess club in America, the Marshall Chess Club. I played chess every day of my life. I recognized what his contribution to the game was, and you know, his games could bring tears to my eyes. They were so beautiful. On the other hand, his pronouncements were, you know, unacceptable about religion, about America, and so forth.
Seems there's a myth here that Fisher, you know, as you talk about in the book, that Fisher was a kind of idiot savant. You talk about how that's just not the way you see it. I mean, he was seen as, you know, socially inept and sometimes incapable of empathy. But you say in the book that his head may have been filled with grids and chess bites, but it also had poetry and song and lyricism.
It certainly did. And you know, it is true that he spent a great portion of his life studying old games and contemporary games and playing chess and going over variations. And just as musicians, just as pianists do. And he was somehow, as a result of that, socially inept. And there were certain things he didn't know about that his culture was lacking. And he admitted it later on in life that he didn't know a lot about life in general because he spent all of his time playing chess, just again, as a pianist might spend all of his time studying music. So he eventually came around after he won the World's Championship in 1972. He became a voracious reader. He tried to self-educate himself at that point and did. For the rest of his life. He read as much as he could.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to that period in his life as we sort of work through it. But let me ask you this. What was chess for him? It's interesting because, you know, some say it was marked by this desire to, you know, intimidate, to dominate, to master. But there must have been a kind of joy in that as well, was there?
Well, yes. Someone once asked him, "What is chess for you, Bobby?" And he said, "Chess is everything." It meant it was his life. He loved playing the game. He was very happy when he was playing the game. He would smile a lot. I mean, he was very, and of course, he was very intense as well when he was playing in competitive chess. It meant a great deal to him. And he had many aspects to his approach to the game. One is that he was extremely competitive. And by the way, his competition was not only devolved around chess, it also applied to when he got into arguments with people or when he was playing other sports, when he was playing tennis at resorts. He wanted to win. He always wanted to win. He had that sense of competitiveness. He had a passion also for the game itself. He wasn't interested in other games, although he learned some games, a few other games. But chess was it for him, and it resonated with him. So he had that. And then he was the ultimate student of the game. He really, you know, you could mention a game that was played in 1880, and he could rattle off the moves. He knew it by heart. On top of all of this, he had a super IQ. His IQ was about 180. So he brought all of these factors together, which made him a great chess player.
I have to ask, and you don't spend a lot of time with this. As I said, it's not a memoir. But I have to ask, what was it like to play a chess game with Bobby Fischer? Can you give some insights into his life simply by the way he played? Focus, intensity? I mean, how do you characterize it?
Yes. Well, the games that I played Bobby, well over 100 games, they were not tournament games. They were speed games, as they're called, games that were done in a matter of minutes. But even the way he moved his pieces, it was like being a concert pianist. He had long fingers. He could throw the pieces on the board almost, and they'd land in their proper squares. And he once told me, he said, "I could tell the strength of a chess player based on the ability of a chess player, based on how they handled pieces. That could be exaggerated, of course, but it was exhilarating to play him because you knew you were going to lose, even if, and I can't even say I ever got a really good game against him, but right. Even when you are had a good game, you sort of knew you were going to lose because he was Bobby Fischer.
Yeah.
And he was like the zeitgeist of chess. It was like playing a computer. And you knew that eventually the computer was going to find its way through the position and you were going to lose. But people often, when they lost to Bobby, they would smile. It was a good feeling because you were playing against a master, a great master. And it didn't matter whether you lost. It was the experience of playing him that counted.
What do we learn about Bobby Fischer by understanding his mother? Talk about Regina, if you would.
Yes, I knew Regina and had many talks with her. She was as bright as a penny. A highly educated woman. She could speak six languages fluently. She got a medical degree later in life, and then after that she got a PhD in hematology. She had two master's degrees. She was a constant student all her life. She wanted Bobby also to be a student all of his life, right. But he wasn't. But he was a student of the game, of course. She was, you might describe her as a stage mother in that she wanted Bobby to have whatever he could get, and she was constantly after other people to come up with money to support him to play in tournaments overseas and that kind of thing. Sometimes he didn't like that, as many teenagers do not. They don't want their parents to interfere. And so, but basically they had a loving relationship, which continued all their lives. And many writers and reporters biographers have indicated that there was a rift. And in one book, it indicated they hadn't spoken in 30 years. It was all untrue. Mm. They were in constant contact through letters, through telegrams, exchanging of gifts and so forth. When he finally met a girl that he thought he would want to marry, he brought that girl to his mom to introduce her. You know? He respected his mother. He loved his mother. When he was on his deathbed, he asked for a photograph of his mother to be near him. So they had a very, very close relationship.
I wonder about, and we'll talk more about this as we go along as well, but I've also heard, I wanted to get your sense of that in some ways the anti-Semitism that came out later in his life, which could be virulent, was somehow a reflection of some kind of antagonism to his mother, who of course was Jewish. What do you make of that?
I don't believe that at all. I think that he did not like some of the conversations that went on in his house in Brooklyn because he felt he couldn't participate in them. His mother would have various intellectuals, Jewish intellectuals, as the case may be, and they would be discussing education and philosophy and government and politics. And Bobby once told me, I hate that kind of conversation. I don't participate. I don't like it. So he might have had a funny or strange or aberrant idea about the Jews, although remember he was Jewish, and his mother was Jewish. Therefore, according to Talmudic law, he was Jewish, and he repudiated it. He also later on in life. By the way, I never personally ever heard him make an anti-Semitic remark. Until he did that on the radio later on, in the 80s and 90s. But growing up, I never heard him say anything like that. And we had talks about religion and other things. He was actually a very religious person when he converted, although not formally converted, but converted to Christianity.
Right.
And he carried a Bible with him. He would not curse or use profanity. He tried to remain sexually pure until he was married, that kind of thing. So he was an interesting character as far as that's concerned.
Yeah.
How he got involved in the anti-Semitism is, you know, I do go into it in the book, but he was influenced, unfortunately, by a book called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was an anti-Semitic tract, which was pure fiction, and yet many people, even today, think that it's nonfiction and that it was true, that there were a group of Jewish leaders who wanted to take over the world. And he somehow, it meant something to him, and he began to rant and rave.
Yeah.
He also had this, and I again mentioned this in the book, he talked about stereotyping, and he said, I reserve the right to stereotype. I reserve the right to generalize. So if he was insulted or cheated or whatever by one person who was Jewish, he would then jump into the idea that, well, then everyone is Jewish is wrong. I mean, it's a fallacy. It's an illogical syllogism. But indeed, those are part of it. The other part, and I refer to David Mamet's book, The Wicked Son, who he talks about self-hating Jews, that there are certain people that just cannot bear being a part of a minority, even though they are born into that minority. And so they jump to the majority. And it is possible that that was part of Bobby. He saw that people were looking down on Jews and he didn't want to be a part of it. So it's complicated. No one really knows what was in Bobby's heart in terms of his anti-Semitism, but it was virulent and it was disgusting and unacceptable.
Frank Brady is with us. His book is called Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the eccentric chess genius Bobby Fischer. Frank Brady is our guest. He knew Fischer. He's written a biography that explores his life. It's called Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. Frank Brady, what do you figure the gift was? I mean, did he have a photographic memory? Did he see the board in a way that it's hard for us to maybe understand the way it spread out? Did he see the potential of moves in a way that was, I mean, what was it, do you figure?
A combination of all of those things in some ways. He did have an absolutely phenomenal memory. For instance, there was a book of Spassky's games that he was reading prior to playing Spassky in the 1972 championship. And there had to be something like 500 games in that book with moves 20, 30, 40, 50 moves long. And it was almost as a parlor game. He would give somebody the book and he'd say, pull out again. Just tell me who Spassky played and what year it was and what tournament. So you'd say, well, Spassky played Korchnoi in Moscow in 1968. And he'd say, okay, and he'd rattle off the moves. He had memorized all 10,000 moves in that book. Now, who could do that? Not many people. So a great deal of what tutored Bobby into the greatness that he had was sort of a structured education. These positions that would arise in almost any game, he had played over and analyzed them and knew about them because they had existed somewhere else. But on top of that, he did have the intelligence to be able to see, you know, very far. I once sat next to him when he was playing in a speed tournament, and I was trying to copy the game. Actually, he was moving too fast. I couldn't copy the moves down. But I was trying to determine by watching him play how deeply he looked forward. And this is just making moves almost by the second.
Yeah.
And he was looking 5, 6, 7 moves deep, whereas the average player, you know, looks like 1 or 2 moves. So he could see further than other people, and he had this pattern of recognition that was very familiar to him. Whatever position came up, he sort of knew it. He was the complete player. I mean, some great players, they're very good in the openings, but maybe not so good in the mid-game, and maybe not so good in the end-game, or maybe they have a combination of some of those things. Bobby was good in every aspect. He was good. He knew the openings inside and out. He, in the middle game, he embraced it. He loved complicated positions. And in the end game, he also knew the end game and was comfortable with it. And so that's why he was so relentless over the board.
There's a match that there's so many great stories of particular games in the book. One I wanted to, in particular, I wanted to talk to you about in 1956. Now, we should say Bobby Fischer's 13 years old. And
yeah.
He plays this game with the former U.S. Open champion, Donald Byrne. It's been called one of the most extraordinary games, really, in history. And he has this strategy, which is kind of remarkable. It's what's called a queen sacrifice. I think that's what it's called. But
yes.
Explain it to us, if you would. What's so extraordinary about that? Mind you, a 13-year-old kid doing this.
Yeah, well, to play without your queen or to give your queen up is almost tantamount to a loss unless you can have something in mind. It's rare in chess. And he saw that by giving up his queen, and he must have seen 10 or 12 or 14 moves deep or maybe longer than that, that there was a way that he could beat Donald Byrne. And it was an exquisite game. And Donald Byrne, as you point out, was the U.S. Open champion at the time. He had just beaten Reshevsky in that same tournament, who was, you know, maybe the number one player in the United States at that time. And Bobby was just this 13-year-old kid. And when Bobby saw those moves in his head, you know, he sat there and he just, you know, like a Buddha. And he was... you know, shooting out the moves like poison darts. And, you know, Byrne sort of didn't know what to do. And you know, before long, he was checkmated. And the game was dubbed the game of the century. And it still is referred to as the game of the century. That it was up until that time, there was no game as beautiful as that. And it was published, by the way, all over the world. And then people began to really wake up. Now, who is this child?
Yeah.
And wait a minute. You know, this is an extraordinary moment in chess. The Soviets became aware of him at that point.
Well, you know, it raises the question that comes later when you talk about how it was that he could be so charming and precocious and then turn to the person he eventually became, which was, you know, more erratic, certainly disturbing. And I'm wondering, what effect do you think that the public attention at such a young age had on all of that? I mean, he was essentially a celebrity at quite a young age.
He was a celebrity. And if you were a chess player and you had dinner with Bobby Fischer or you hung out with him, it was like hanging out with a movie star. You know, he gave autographs. He was constantly being pursued by the press. But the press often has distorted the role of chess players and made them look as if they were, if not insane, certainly very, very eccentric.
Right.
And some of these stories really began to hurt Bobby. And when that happened, He started to absolutely abandon giving interviews, and he really didn't want to do it. It hurt him deeply if someone told, stretched the truth a little bit or exaggerated a little bit. People would make you know, journalists would make up things, and they would ask patronizing questions, which he also didn't want to answer, you know, like, do you like girls and that kind of stuff. And he didn't want to answer those questions. It was too personal. He once said to a journalist, why don't you ask me something usual instead of something unusual? Mm. I'll answer usual questions, you know. So it hurt him a great deal, and certainly after the 72 match, he went almost 20 years without giving an interview. Mm.
One thing we should put in context, Frank Brady, about the 72 match and the matches that sort of led up to that is the Cold War. This is an important context, I think, to understand not only the way the Soviets, the Russians were thinking, but Bobby Fischer in the United States. I mean, this was bound up in an intense kind of competition, and the stakes seemed really high.
Well, certainly, the Soviet Union had hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of players who played steadily. Mm-hmm. They had one tournament throughout many of the cities in Russia, in which 700,000 people participated. The United States Chess Federation, on the other hand, had only 2,000 people in their entire membership, and there were very few tournaments being played here in the United States. Chess was, whether you were a farmer, a factory worker, a doctor, a politician, in the Soviet Union, that was the game. Chess was almost scoffed upon here in the United States. You know, we had baseball, we had football, we had basketball, we had other games that we looked up to. So when Bobby Fischer, this kid from Brooklyn, came along without governmental help, by the way, he never got a dollar from the government, never. Whereas the Soviets treated their chess players as if they were gods, if you will, and gave them salaries, gave them trainers, gave them seconds to go along with their trips, took them all over the place. Bobby was by himself, essentially, and it was, you know, the proverbial David slaying Goliath. We beat the Soviets at their own game, or Bobby beat the Soviets at their own game, I should say, not we.
Well, it seems throughout his career, Frank Brady, that he charged the Soviets with, I mean, not only were the conditions unfair, but he suggested that they outright cheated, colluded.
Yes. Well, they did, in a sense, they did.
Yeah.
And more than just a sense. I mean, the Soviets were very famous for discussing the games during the game. In other words, a player would get up from his board, walk over to another player and say, what do you think of this position?
Wow.
And so Bobby wouldn't think of doing anything like that. And he became furious that they were doing that. They also agreed to draws so they would have plenty of rest time, whereas Bobby was fighting for a win every single game without rest time and playing long, long, very, very difficult games. So later on, this came out that indeed they were ganging up on him. Mm. They didn't want to lose their championship. And I think a very important thing that I point out in the book is that they actually started a laboratory in Moscow on Golgolsky Boulevard, where there were psychologists and chess players and sports people who spent 10 years studying the games of Bobby Fischer so that the Soviets could defeat him, and they were unable to do it. That's how important, you know, you can imagine a group of 10 or 15 or 20 men meeting every single day in a laboratory trying to figure out Bobby's personality and his kinds of moves and so forth. It's an incredible story. And some of this is now coming out through KGB files that are being released. Mm.
You write about, and one of the sort of delightful parts of the book, I have to say, is that you write about the build up to the World Chess Championship in 72, and it's kind of this 3-year process with all these interzonal candidates matches and all this process. And you go through the different matches, and each and every one of them is incredibly intriguing. I want to talk about one in particular, Tigran Petrosian, who is one of the Soviets' great chess champions. He's sort of in the way to get to Boris Spassky for Bobby Fischer. And you talk about the match that he plays in Buenos Aires.
Yes.
What's so extraordinary about it at the time, I have to say, for Brady, is they're in this theater with, 1,200 people, and thousands upon thousands of people are paying attention to this around the world.
Absolutely. He did capture the imagination of the world public because they recognized that he was coming on his way up. And if he beat Petrosian, he would then be one of the first Americans ever to have a shot at the world's championship. And that was a difficult match for him. I mean, he actually lost a couple of games.
Yeah.
But he won the match, and it was just an incredible moment in time. And I think you mentioned that he was on the cover of all these magazines at that point, even before he won the World's Championship.
Right, right.
New York Times Magazine section had a front page color photograph of him sitting at the board with Petrosian, Sports Illustrated, Time, Newsweek. He was already a national hero before he even won the World's Championship.
And I like how you talk about it was a phenomenon in the United States, how people were buying up chess sets left and right in the United States.
Yes, they were. And it was at that point, people wanted to learn. So chess masters who had heretofore had trouble eking out a living, all of a sudden were giving lessons and charging large amounts of money for it. Macy's and Bloomingdale's and other stores were selling out of their chess sets. The Marshall Chess Club, of which I'm a member, doubled its membership from 300 to 600 in a matter of weeks. It was just an incredible phenomenon. You had to learn chess in 1972 in the United States, and everyone was learning it. And people still play that. In other words, people who really didn't pay any attention to chess prior to 1972 are still playing today as a result of Bobby Fischer.
Mm. Well, I want to ask you about the Spassky Fischer match. What's so great about it is all the play-up that came into it, the way you say that while the negotiations were going on, and there were incredibly intricate kinds of negotiations, that Spassky and Fischer went to the mountains to train, as you put it.
Yes.
Talk about that, because Fischer goes to the mountain retreat in the Catskills, Grossinger's,
right.
a hotel there.
Yes.
To be, as you say, kind of removed from the pressures and the distractions of New York City. And he trains his mind, but he also trains his body. I mean, how do you train for a chess match? Talk about that.
Well, Bobby always felt that you could not separate mind from body. And so he always tried to keep himself in shape all his life. Mm-hmm. He swam. He bowled. He played tennis. He lifted weights. He was in perfect physical shape. Broad shoulders. If you saw him walk, he looked like he was a basketball player or an Olympic swimmer. I mean, he was a powerful man physically. And he trained himself to do that. While he was at the Catskills, he went over as I mentioned previously, went over just about every game that Spassky had ever played. He studied it. He had some of his friends up there. But no one really helped Bobby Fischer. Some of his chess friends, he might play some chess with them. But often when he was truly studying, he would ask them to go away from his chess board so that he could just study by himself personally and privately. And he was really feeling good at that point. He was feeling good physically. He was making money from – he had written a book and was making money from the book. Mm. He was making money from certain appearances where he would show up. He wrote some really charming letters to his mother, by the way, at that point. She was already in Europe studying for her medical degree and how good he felt. And he said at one point, "I don't want to lose myself. in terms of the eternal values. I don't want all this to go to my head. Mm. I mean, he was being very rational.
Yeah. But then put that up against, Frank Brady, the demands then he made during this match, which some people see them as tawdry and petty because he was concerned about the amount of money that he would make. But you say that people really fail to understand that this wasn't, as you say, a temper tantrum or Fisher being neurotic, but, you know, he's protecting his financial interests. It was kind of a shrewd business.
It certainly was. It was shrewd, and indeed, I think we have to remember or know that Bobby was brought up in poverty.
Yeah.
And so actual poverty. I mean, his mother was at one point when she was pursuing her education, she was also getting unemployment insurance for a big $22 a week. And she was a single parent raising two children. So it was very, very difficult for him. And he wasn't getting any governmental assistance. So, you know, Anatoly Karpov, who eventually did become champion of the world, once said that Bobby Fischer was the first union leader of chess, because he said, I'm not going to play unless you pay my price. You have to pay my price, or I'm just not going to play. And he felt that he was as great as Muhammad Ali or as great as Vladimir Horowitz. He wanted to be on a stage. He wanted everything to be silent and quiet. He wanted proper conditions. He wanted great lighting. And he wanted a lot of money. And some people look down upon that, just like some people, I guess, look down upon authors that make a lot of money. Rather, you know, aren't you doing it just for the art? Well, some people do. But just because you make a lot of money doesn't make you a poor artist or a poor author.
Well, it's such a great story. I mean, Fischer refuses to show up at first until a London financier comes up with more money. And then he gets this call from Henry Kissinger, who gives him the nudge to finally play. Say something about that.
Well, Kissinger called him. Bobby was staying at a friend's house in New York. And the question is he going to play? Is he not going to play? Is he going to go to Iceland? And Kissinger said, you have to do this for our country. You know, this is a Cold War we're in. You have to defeat the Soviets. You must do it. And that really spurred Bobby on. And at that point in his life, he was a patriot. And he said, I'll go. And did.
Frank Brady is with us. His book, Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Frank Brady. We're talking about his biography of Bobby Fischer, Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. Frank Brady, I just wanted to give us a sense of the match. I mean, you go through it in sort of glorious detail, I have to say, in the book. You know, and it's marked by Fischer's complaints about the lighting and the board and the placement of the crowd and the cameras being too loud. But then there's also intrigue when it seems Fischer is getting the upper hand during the match. All of a sudden, the Soviet delegation begins to be suspicious. And then there's this accusation that Fischer may be influencing Spassky by chemical substances, if not by electronic means. Talk about it.
Yeah, it was a strange, surrealistic moment. Not only moment, months of this kind of nonsense that the Soviets were bringing up. They wanted to spoil Bobby's image. They wanted to find some way that they could prove that he was not really better than Spassky. So, you know, they thought maybe he had some kind of an electronic device in his chair, and they took the chair apart, mm-hmm. and they x-rayed it, and all they found was some sort of blob of wood filler or something in the chair. And then they thought maybe from the lights, and they had a Reykjavik policeman get on a ladder on the stage and go up to the lights and take the lights down, and he did find something. Two dead flies.
Right.
And so it was all – it wasn't done out of publicity. They really were trying to tarnish Bobby's image and trying to find a way to get out of this because they saw that Spassky was going to lose the match. Mm. He began losing games, and he wasn't himself. So it was an incredible moment. It was, you know, thousands of people in the Lagerstal Hall, the largest arena in Iceland, came, and there were hundreds of journalists there. It was like Lisbon during the war. There was gossip and back and forth and press conferences, and Bobby didn't want to see anybody. He stayed in a presidential suite at the Hotel Loftleader and would only come out to play his game, and occasionally he would go bowling with a friend or something, or go swimming, but he wasn't giving any interviews. He wasn't even seeing some of his closest friends who were staying at the same hotel.
Here's an email from John, who writes from Salt Lake City. I lived in D.C. during the Spassky-Fisher match. The coverage in all media forms rivaled that of a Super Bowl. D.C. has always been a chess town, but this was really something to behold, John writes. Every day the Washington Post presented the game move by move. Truly, he says, one of the greatest sporting events I ever witnessed.
Yeah, well, you know, the BBC did a series of the greatest sporting events of all time. I think they took 10 events a few years ago, and one of them was the Fisher-Spassky match, and did a documentary on it.
I want to ask you about what happens next for Bobby Fischer after he wins. Goes into what you call the wilderness years, and I'm wondering... at first, it seems, you know, Fisher's going to settle into something approaching normal life. He wanted to meet girls, kind of recharge his life. He goes to live on the campus of the Worldwide Church of God, in it, of itself, a kind of an extraordinary story. Lives on their campus, kind of keeps to himself, reads, as you said earlier. But what happens to him, do you think? What's going on in his life at this point?
Well, he achieved what he wanted to achieve, which was to become champion of the world. Honestly, I really feel that since he proclaimed that he was a genius and was in terms of, you know, IQ, but he said, I'm not just a genius in chess. I am a genius in other things as well. Mm. And I think he had in his mind, and who knows what was in his mind, that maybe he could achieve something else in some other field. Maybe he'd become a scientist, an inventor, or whatever. And so, but he had to educate himself. And so every day he'd get up, was a late riser, he'd go to the library, he'd go to the bookstores, he would buy books, he would read and read and read. He, again, eschewed any publicity. He didn't want it. Didn't publicly play a game of chess for 20 years.
Yeah.
He was sort of like a Greta Garbo. He wanted to be alone. Occasionally, he'd like to see a friend or J.D. Salinger. He didn't want any notice. He didn't want to receive letters. He didn't want to receive phone calls. Eventually, he began moving all over the L.A. and Pasadena areas just so that people couldn't find him. And money didn't mean anything to him, really. I mean, he had offers of, it's hard to believe, he had offers of almost $10 million or maybe more than $10 million for appearances and sponsorship of products. And he felt it was all too undignified for him.
Mm.
He didn't want it. And yet he was, at one point, he became almost like a derelict. He was living on Skid Row. And his mother had to send her Social Security checks to him to keep him going. But, you know, the word recluse or hermit really can be applied to Bobby Fischer during those years.
I think people should hear his voice. I wanted to play a clip from an interview. This was before he really went into seclusion. It's sort of at the height, I guess, maybe of his powers in many ways. This was, I think, just after the Spassky-Fisher match in 1972. It's a conversation with Dick Cavett on the Dick Cavett Show. Seems to reveal the way he interacted with people, which there was kind of awkwardness to it. Something was charming about him. But it's interesting to hear his voice, don't you think, Frank Brady?
Yes, absolutely. Let's hear it.
And you made some rather strong charges against them a couple of times involving...
cheating.
Cheating, I think, is the word that I was looking for. Yeah. What was the evidence of that?
Well, one tournament I played in back in 62, that was a specific one I was talking about. They prearranged about a dozen games among themselves to eliminate me.
How did they prearrange it? I mean, they had the strategy worked out among each other.
Right, yeah.
That isn't illegal, though, is it? Is that conspiracy?
No, it's against the rules, but...
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's what I meant, against the rules. Yeah. So that would be the kind of cheating you mean.
Oh, well, also, sometimes they would discuss the game among themselves while it's in progress, get advice from each other, and a few little things like that. I complained a lot about it back then.
Have you changed? You know, all the press about you has talked about your cantankerous period where you would go stomping out and say, I cannot work under these lights and so forth. And then after the period where you were away, you came back milder.
Yeah, you could say that.
There have been all kinds of rumors, like there's a certain woman who changed. Someone gave him a pill. I don't know what the others are. Those are two of them.
I just sort of handle journalists a little better, you know. Handle myself with people a little better. I haven't changed that much.
You haven't changed that much. You just know how to handle the press now.
Right, right.
You say, Frank Brady, that the press was a puzzle that Bobby Fischer really couldn't solve. That he figured that in many ways they weren't as interested in how he moved the chess pieces, but the scandal or the comedy, I think, is how you put it, of his life.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, publications like the National Enquirer and others, you know, love to find any kind of scandal that Bobby might or might not have been involved in. And, again, they just made up things, and he just detested them. He actually once said that if a journalist wrote something illegal about him, would it be a crime to commit a murder? I mean, actually said that, and he was serious. I mean, and he just stopped doing it. One of the problems was there was an article that appeared in 1961 in Harper's Magazine, written by a writer by the name of Ralph Ginsberg, that really made Bobby look homophobic and misogynistic and stupid and uneducated and so forth. And Bobby just became livid as a result of that article. And it was really at that point that he stopped really cooperating with the press, despite what he just said to Cavett. Yeah, he handled the press a little better, but he didn't want it. Mm.
I wanted to ask you about long story, of course. He ends up playing in defiance of American officials there was an embargo on Yugoslavia at the time. He plays a match at the time, and he becomes a fugitive, essentially.
Certainly did.
I think the most startling comments he makes are right after 9/11, in the hours actually after 9/11, to a Philippine radio talk program. Virulent anti-Semitism here, of course, anti-Americanism. How do you explain those comments? He is beside himself with rage and anger about the United States and about, you know, some Jewish conspiracy.
Well, there are a couple of factors, and this is not a defense of Bobby in any way that I'm going to say it. I'm just giving you the details. Bobby felt that he could play or should be able to play this match in Serbia, even though there was a war on and even though there were sanctions against Americans involved in any kind of commercial endeavor, and there was a $5 million match. He felt he should be able to do that. All he was doing, he felt, was move wooden pieces across the board. Mm. Why is that illegal? And when they swore out a warrant for his arrest and threatened him with $250,000 in fines and/or 10 years in prison. I mean, he really became livid. That was one factor, livid against the United States. Yeah. The other factor is that he brought a lawsuit against a writer, a journalist, who violated a contract. And he lost the lawsuit. It was thrown out of court, and he felt that the jurisprudence system in the country was corrupt. And so he began this hate-hate relationship with the United States and just didn't want anything to do with it.
You know,
so he became a man without a country. Yeah. I mean, there was a warrant out for his arrest. Interpol was searching for him, and he lived for many years abroad.
I guess the question comes up from time to time when people hear those the intensity of those statements that he lost it, you know, that he was crazy. You don't think so, though, it seems.
I so many people disagree with me. I think by saying he was crazy lets him off the hook. Hmm. I don't think he was crazy. And psychiatrists that knew him as a child, as a young man, and even toward the end of his life, say that he was not psychotic. He was disturbed. He was paranoid, but all of us have a certain paranoia among us. Mm. He came from a troubled childhood. But it makes him, in a sense, worse to know that this is the way he felt. No, I don't think he was crazy. He had no delusions. He had no hallucinations. He was just angry,
yeah.
Mean.
Less than a minute, so maybe it's an unfair question to ask this finally, but was his life a waste of potential? Do you see it that way?
I'll give you a quote, and the quote is not in my book, but it's a quote that he made, and that is, "I have always been a loser in the game of life."
Frank Brady. His book is called Endgame, Bobby Fischer's remarkable rise and fall from America's brightest prodigy to the edge of madness. He joined us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Frank, thanks very much for the time.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for the opportunity.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Cynthia Martinez. The show is produced by Elaine Clark.